that exists among religious people as well as the world. When I first started this particular series on pornography, I was estimating that about 25% of the men in our congregations had a problem with this. I have since realized I was wrong with that, and that now the numbers are looking more like about 40% amongst our brethren across the nation. In the religious world in general, a conference just ended in Charlotte, North Carolina, where they had a number of very prominent, actually it was 30 different prominent participants from the religious, conservative religious communities. And what they did with the Barna study that was preceding that is they figured about 63% of those participants that answered the question, 63% of the men that are regular church goers have a problem with pornography. Not just a casual glance, but a problem. Among the women, it was about 38%. And I'm not quite sure, because we haven't polled our congregations officially, nor maybe should we. But at any rate, if we are running true to those, anywhere near those numbers, we have a serious, serious problem with controlling the electronic devices that are amongst us. When I talk with people young and old about not only the computers, but I talk about the cell phones and some of the things that are going on with Facebook and Twitter and Google Plus and some of the devices that are out there, what I'm seeing and what I'm hearing reported with those members of the church that come and see me for various things or call me for advice on things, we have a significant problem also with sexting on our cell phones. As a matter of fact, that's running probably about 16% of our young people are talked into putting themselves out there on a cell phone. That appears to be a way of dating now and a way of affirming love, that if you love me, you'll send me a picture of yourself in your private moments. And so those are out there as well. Whatever the deal is, that we as Christians are challenged not to let our electronic devices control us where we act out of harmony with what the Bible teaches on the different things about morality. We have to be very careful. And here's a problem with electronic devices, is that those often are driven by impulse, by spur of the moment. But yet these things don't last just for that moment. They go on and on and on. Back in the day when many of us were much younger, we were talking about magazines, and Playboy was one of those magazines. Playboy announced last month that they were going to stop printing the nude pictures in Playboy magazine. This is a real thing. That basically they were just going to go to script. And the reason they were doing that is that the demand, it's the demand of the internet has exceeded the demand for the magazines. As a matter of fact, the sales on Playboy itself have reduced below the millions into about 800,000 guys or people that want to read the articles in there. And there won't be any more pictures like that. I find that just amazing, that the Hugh Hefner Playboy age that gave birth to this pandemic now has been engulfed by the way this thing has grown. We live in a very serious time when we as Christians are going to have to fortify ourselves, to teach and to instruct certainly our young people regarding the proper use of our bodies, that God has made our bodies for His glory. And we are to glorify God in our body and our spirit, which are His. The things that are done in secret are sometimes even ashamed to speak of. And yet, what we are called upon is to take a look at this particular very detailed subject. The topic tonight, by its very nature, I'm going to be try to be as plain as I can be. And yet, I'm very aware that there are some very young ones in the audience. So I'm going to try to be a little careful, but I'm going to be very blunt tonight on a lot of the things that I'm going to say. I want to know, or I want you to think for a moment with me, is where did you learn about the facts of life? Each of us has been at different stages in the culture, and we have learned about the facts of life in some way. Most folks answer that they learned about it in the shower room at school. They learned when someone was passing out pictures or telling stories of their conquest. And what we realize sometimes is that people have not learned the facts of life from the right source. When we have allowed the devil to become our schoolmaster on things of sexuality, let's not be surprised when we reap the whirlwind. That godly parents have an obligation, a divine obligation. As we raise our children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, there's an obligation to teach them respect for their body and respect for the body of others. As Christians and as godly families, we are to present ourselves as a living, our bodies as a living sacrifice, holy before God, as we talked about this morning. You see, everything God made is good. In the very beginning, after everything he said it's good except for one thing. It was not good for man to be alone. You know, that's still true. It's not good for man to be alone. Men do a lot of weird things when they're alone. But it is not good for man to be alone. God made a helper for him. God made a counterpart for him. And we'll talk about that role in just a moment. But where did we learn about the facts of life? I hear a lot of people say, well, I learned them from the world, or we had the talk. But more often than not, what I'm hearing from people that are in very serious entrapment, in very serious strongholds with the devil, what I hear is they didn't learn it at all in their home. I'm talking about Christian homes. Mom and dad were embarrassed to talk about it. That's just not something we talked about in our family. But yet, there is a part of us that is certainly curious, and we're going to find out about this somehow. If we allow our children to go into the times when they start mate selection, dating and all that, and we allow them to go in there unarmed, without the knowledge of what God would have them to do, the devil's been teaching somebody to seduce your son or your daughter. And that's what you need to do, is to have done the counterpart in that. I say you, not accusatory, but simply that's what we as Christians need to do. Sometimes we have learned our messages from the world, and we have just kind of hoped to keep our kids innocent. But we have passed the age of innocence for many. As a matter of fact, by the time a child is in the first grade, they have viewed some level of pornography on the internet. That's a serious thing. By the time that they get up into middle school and all, they've seen the whole show and even some of the perversions that go on. And if they haven't seen it, they have learned of the places to go and see it. Some of that has been inadvertent. They're not sitting there necessarily scanning that, but they have inadvertently clicked onto those sites. Godly parents are going to need to put some stops on all of that. There are some controls that can be there, but I really suggest that needs to be strongly monitored. There's a number of ways to do that I won't go into this evening. We'll talk about that later if you want to ask me. But godly parents need to train their children and to teach them about the facts of life. I want to go to 1 Corinthians 4, verse 3 through 8. And it says, "This is the will of God, even your sanctification, that you abstain from fornication." I talked to a grown man, a member of the church, on the subject of fornication. He had been visiting a parlor where he had had a woman act out his fetishes. And he had been doing this very regularly, going to services at all the services, and yet slipping into a parlor and having his fetishes satisfied. And as we talked, I spent a lot of time with him, what I found out, this man his issues, as we talked about fornication, he asked me to explain fornication. And he asked me after I told him, talked with him about what he was doing. And I said, you know, if you go any further with this, then that's going to be adultery or fornication. And what he said is, well, I don't think so. And he had defined fornication much like Bill Clinton did, when he said, I haven't had sex with that woman. We live in a day when the words are being redefined. And when that happens, that takes some of the danger and the punch out of the words. Do not assume we're talking about the same thing. We talk about fornication as we read our Bibles. We talk about adultery. Those words need to be defined. And basically, what we would have is adultery being unfaithful. Did I lose the microphone? A marriage partner who steps outside the marriage. Fornication, however, is a much broader term and has to do with any sexual activity, period. Any sexual activity. As a matter of fact, in the book of Jude, there the word fornication is used in terms with the men of Sodom who were homosexual. And it says that they committed fornication there in the book of Jude. So the word is used not just in heterosexual sex, but is also used in homosexual activity. We look at the first part of the book of Romans on the roll call of the damned. And there Paul talks about all the things people did and unnatural affection and many of those things that were the sexual sins, burning in lust, men burning in lust one toward another and women and so forth, doing the things that were unseemly, he says. And three times in there, the saddest words to me in the Bible, and for this cause, God gave them up. That's serious stuff. And so as we read this verse, we need to understand what fornication is. That it's not just heterosexual sex. It is all inclusive of things that are out of bounds in the sexual life. That each one of you knows how to possess himself of his own vessel in sanctification and honor. What does that mean? What is your own vessel? He is talking there about your sex organs. He is talking about that which makes you the gender you are. And no, there is no in-between gender. He talks here about that we know how to possess our gender-identifying organs and to have those in sanctification, set apart. That's what sanctify means. Have our gender set apart and honored. That's what a child of God does. And then he says, here's what you don't do, not in the passion of lust, even as the Gentiles who do not know God. Now, what does that tell us? It tells us that people that don't know God act one way, and people who do know God act a whole different way. You see, there is a clear distinction here. I don't do these things because I am a child of God. I don't do these things because I have surrendered my vile passions to the will of God. And because of that surrender, Jesus has saved me. Not in the passion of lust as the Gentiles who know not God. And then he says that no man transgress and wrong his brother in this matter. In other words, that we don't create offenses with one another in that sexual arena. Because the Lord, look at this, here's a threat. Because the Lord is an avenger in all these things, as also we forewarned you and testified. What it says here is, if you act that way, if you step outside of God's bounds, if you are a fornicator, if you are one that does not possess their vessel in honor, you use it to flaunt and tempt and tease and commit immorality with folks, if you do that, then it says God is going to get you. You will pay a price for that. That he is an avenger in all these things. And then it says this, verse 7, for God called us not for uncleanness. That's the word that has to do with a whole array of a perversion. God did not call you to use your body that way, but in sanctification. There's that word again. And then he says, another stern threat. Therefore, he that rejects not man, but God, who gives His Holy Spirit unto you. What that says is God has set the boundary of our sexuality, and we are not to try to move that boundary for any reason. That's what that says. Well, did you know that was in your Bible? You may want to keep that verse handy. In the Old Testament, God saw stepping outside of sexual boundaries as worthy of the death penalty. The death penalty was extended for incest. We won't look at all these, but these slides will be available to you. The death penalty existed for incest. That is, if you have relations with someone that's in your own family, close blood relative. Adultery, rape, whoredom, bestiality. And in that case, both the beast and the person were to be killed. Sodomy, that's homosexuality. And a non-virgin bride. And for all those things, the God of heaven who made the bodies of the individuals, God said these things under the old law were worthy of the death penalty. I tell you what, we wouldn't have a population issue if that were going on today. That would be a house cleaned and a half if that were going on. But God said in His Ten Commandments, in that Decalogue to the law of Moses, one of those Ten Commandments, thou shalt not commit adultery. And He talked about not coveting after your neighbor's wife. What are those all about? Those are all about keeping your sexual boundaries. We'll look at the New Testament in just a moment. But in 2 Samuel chapter 12, verse 2 through 15, you remember Jonadab, and his advice that Amnon go in and basically feign sickness so that he can trick his sister Tamar and David and be in the same room. And what he did, it said that he was just madly in love. He had a relationship addiction, evidently. And what he does is Jonadab comes up with this diabolical scheme of how to seduce Tamar. And they carry it out. But it is very interesting that at the end of that episode, after Amnon has raped his sister, incest under the old law, what it says is that fantasy he had was abolished when he had the reality. And it resulted in this. The hatred wherewith he hated her was greater than the love wherewith he had loved her. This woman's life was, her innocence was taken from her by diabolical advice. That advice still goes on today with people talking about how to seduce each other. And that goes on in the internet. All right, it may go on the interstate too. Actually, some of the hoochie joints you see up and down the road, it probably goes on in there too. I want to talk with you very, very plainly now regarding males and females. I think that this is a sensitive part of this lesson, but I think it is one that is much needed and is much more detailed than I will give tonight. But the male body, a lot of people don't understand the male body. The male body regulates its sexual hormones and so forth based on a supply and demand. The more demand, the more supply. And so with men that are regularly into their sexual activity, what happens is they have a sexual buildup. It's supply and demand. Marriage or sex in marriage releases important hormones into the male brain. One of those during the sexual arousal and the sexual act, one of those is dopamine. It is the feel-good hormone. And that's where that pleasure comes in during that. But there's another hormone that kicks in here. It's called oxytocin. The oxytocin is a chemical in the brain that is used to bind a person or to bond a person to another individual. Both of those are released in the brain during the sex act. By the way, the largest sex organ you have is your head. That's where the thoughts take place, and the body responds. But during the sex act, hopefully with his wife, the male is releasing the dopamine and the oxytocin, and there's a third one we'll talk about, And literally what happens is when those hormones are reserved for that person and that person alone, there is a bonding that takes place. And we'll talk about the whole nature of that bonding in just a moment. In other words, a male can become addicted to his wife, and a female can become addicted to her husband, and that's how the brain is trained to find each of them desirable. Now just think about that a minute. If you didn't find the person desirable, it wouldn't take very long for there not to be any children, right? So when a couple has a new and exciting experience, one of those thrilling, more than average excitement rendezvous, then the body also produces another chemical in the brain. And for just the short version of that is PEA. And also that mixed with the adrenaline impacts the brain in such a pleasurable way that it is almost identical on the scopes, the measurements. It's almost identical to the high of crack cocaine. And that's how you become intoxicated with the pleasure of each. That's how God's designed us. Those chemicals set off in the brain. And that's how God has designed us to be exciting to our mate. Now, a great sex life, don't get me wrong, ladies. I'm not saying that you need to be more frequent with your husband. But a great sex life will not solve the problems in your marriage, but it will ramp up the husband's affection and attraction to his wife because of those hormones that get released during that process. Most men, I firmly believe, do not go around looking for ways to be turned on. Because if the man lets his guard down, he can get turned on pretty easily. Men are turned on usually by the visual, and there's plenty of visual all around us, and there's also visual on the internet and our other sources. And most men get turned on by that visual stimulation. That's how you're designed, and that starts kicking off those hormones. So what I really believe is that most men, contrary to most men go around looking for how to be turned on all the time, I believe men go around trying to stay turned off. And here's why. If men were turned on all the time, they wouldn't be able to do anything. And so we have to regulate, to pull back on this. And that's, according to this writer here, most men have a lifelong struggle with trying to control their sexuality, try to keep themselves turned on, to keep their hormones in check, so that they can go on with the other areas, the balance of productivity in their life with their jobs and their means of supporting their families. I want to tell you what. Marriage means that a man should not have to fight the sexual battle by himself. Now, no wife is responsible for her husband's choices. Even a man whose wife withholds herself from him does not have an excuse to seek sexual pleasures outside of marriage, such as sex with himself or using other mechanisms or people. When I talk with members of the church, there's two sides to the equation of pornography. The one is the one who's viewing the porn or doing the online affairs. The other is the other partner. And so when I talk with members of the church about the other partner, I get some very strange roadblocks or some very strange responses. Sometimes, and this isn't strange, but sometimes there's physical things going on. A person may be diabetic, a person may have thyroid problems, we may have health problems, we may have other stuff going on. That's not what I'm talking about tonight. There may be periods of time we have to be abstinent because someone physically just cannot be available. But here's what I am talking about. Those members of the church, and I ask people what their frequency is, and this is some of the answers I get. One gentleman with a porn problem told me, he said, well, our frequency is about four times a year if I'm lucky. That's once every 3 months. Okay? He's married. And what he added to that is, I had more sex before I was married than I did after I was married. And that shouldn't have been either. But another one told me once a year. Then one said, well, never. Those days are over, I guess. And another one said, well, once every 6 months. Another one said, well, on my birthday. And someone said, four times a day. I think that's a little overkill. Another one said 2 to 3 times a week, except during the menstrual cycle. And so what we see is kind of an erratic pattern. When we ask the people who have the porn problem, we see an erratic response. If those answers are true, and I take them to be true, but if those are true, then we have a problem not only on the pornography side, but on the bedroom side. And people, because they are sexually frustrated, going to another source. That does not excuse going to pornography, but it simply says there's more to it than this. Let's look at what God says on this first. He talks about those, the works of the flesh, amongst which he lists adultery and fornication and lasciviousness. And he lists your sexual sins there. He talks about those who are without natural affection. We'll fix that typo. Without natural affection in Romans 1, 31 and 32. We live in an age that rationalizes having the body parts where they don't fit. And thus, we get such crazy things as a sexual experimentation with all sorts of, there's no end to it, of all the things people come up with, different ways to sin. In Matthew 5, 27 through 30, there the famous passage about don't look on a woman to lust after her. But have you ever looked at that passage very closely? Because here in this Sermon on the Mount, he says, whoever looks on a woman to lust after her has committed adultery with her already in his heart. He goes to the brain. And he talks about what's going on in the brain as you look at that woman. Okay, remember those chemicals I told you about? What's going on in that brain? What's going on if a person goes off in secret thinking about that woman? That's the brain. That's the connection, the committing adultery already in your heart is what he's talking about. But look at the context. He talks about first looking on a woman to lust after her for the purpose of developing lust. And then he moves into a section that doesn't seem to fit in the context. If your hand offends you, cut it off. And if your eye offends you, pluck it out. And then he goes into the passage that talks about adultery and divorce. And I just have to ask the question, did the context change? And as I look at that, I have to ask myself, what's the eye used for? What's your hand used for? And I think what I'm seeing there, it's a sexual context. He talks about looking to lust, then he talks about adultery, and in the middle of that, he's talking about your eye and your hand. Now, has that got anything to do with anything? I think it does. And I believe that he's talking there about if you can't control where your eye's looking, you'd be better not to have your eyes. And if you can't control where your hands are, then you'd be better off not to have your hands. I believe that very much is what that context is talking about, among some other things. But then he talks in 2 Peter 2 and verse 14 about those who have eyes full of adultery. And look at this, and cannot cease from sin. These are people that have just looked and lusted and looked and lusted so long that they have trained their brain not to see a woman, but to see a sex organ. Some of the scariest things are said to me in private during my clinical practice. And some of those from members of the church. And I won't repeat those in the pulpit. They're not nice for nice company. But some awful things about viewing women as sex objects, and the men viewing the women viewing the men as a sex object. As a matter of fact, there was one group of ladies that was talking. Well, I know the Bible says that we shouldn't commit adultery, but if you did, who would you do it with? It's like, sisters, why would that conversation ever come up among godly women? And you know what the answer was? Clooney. George Clooney. Oh, my. How degraded have we made ourselves when we make a statement like that and we say, I would commit adultery if the situation were right. That's what that statement said. Well, their ears are still burning. Evil men and seducers, who are seducers. What's going to happen to them? They don't stop where they start. They get worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. And what deceiving means is you take that which is wrong and you talk yourself into it being okay. That usually is done by comparison. We'll look at some other things. So much material here. And then we find in 2 Peter about those that entice unsteadfast souls. Here's someone just coming out of the darkness of the world, and they are seduced by someone who is a member of the church. And that's what he talks about there in 2 Peter. Job said, I made a covenant with my eyes not to look upon a maiden. Now, the book of Job is very likely a patriarchal age book. And way back then in that age, they were still realizing that you had to pay attention to keep your eyes in the right place. Now, I want to tell you what. They didn't have the clothes we have today. And if Job's going to make a covenant with his eyes not to look upon a maiden, and they're pretty much all sheeted up. And yet he needed to watch and be careful that his eyes were in the right place. When we come to the internet, Patrick Kearns identifies that there's at least 10 kinds of people that go to the internet for internet pornography. And you can look at those, and I'm not going to say a whole lot about those, because basically anyone who's going to the internet for their sex life has a problem. So I'm going to cover that more generally. But those are the types that Kearns identifies. Okay, we're going to look at some criteria here. Frequent viewing for longer periods of time than intended. This is a person that will set up half the night just surfing. By the way, those who surf during pornography, who surf the net, it is not about, I'm going to use some straight terms here, it's not about orgasm, because once that happens, person's done. It's not about that. It's about chasing the pre-orgasmic high. And that's what that surfing's all about, over and over and over. And that's where the addiction comes in, is chasing that high in order to have some kind of experience. People go to the internet for these reasons. They go because, and I hear this all the time, they're bored, they had a stressful day, they're anxious, they're mad at their mate. And that's true across the board of men and women who have problem with internet addictions. Sometimes a person has tried to quit, but find that they have periods of times that maybe they've abstained, but they go right back to it. And then when they don't do this, they find themselves being more irritable. Those are like withdrawal symptoms, very much in this addiction. Sometimes people escalate in their behaviors. They just really act out on the internet, and they go deeper and deeper, because remember, evil men and seducers will wax worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. What that says is where you start is not where you stop. Remember the things we talked about earlier today about tolerance building? When a person starts with just topless and starts there, after a while, that's not going to satisfy that individual. They're going to want to look at more and more and more. Same with the women, but we'll talk about them in just a moment. But deceiving family and friends in order to protect the internet activity. Oh, I don't know how that got on there. Well, oh my, how did that happen? Oh yeah, they know. Oh my, yeah. All right. And also online, there are some illegal activities. There's legal professionals that sit there and monitor and do some luring also. For the predators that are on the internet. Actually, I can tell you a member of the church who was caught. He was on the road, and he was caught as he was out here trying to make arrangements to rendezvous with a 15-year-old girl. He knew, or he thought he knew her age. But unfortunately, fortunately for him, very fortunately, because he went to prison. And now he's very humbled by that. But basically he was arrested in that sting operation, posting of sexting or posting of ages of people that are underage, that is illegal. And that will create some very serious legal problems and get a person on a sex offender registry just before quick. You remember Jared, the Subway sandwich man, and the rendezvous that he thought he was having privately, but it turns out that now he's got a lot of time to think about that, as does his business partner. Sometimes people will even jeopardize losing a relationship or a job. They'll get on the internet at work, shut their door during a break or during some other time, and be out here online. Most companies now have a zero tolerance policy. You lose your job if you bring that stuff into the company. Now, let me talk about myths. A lot of times people who are into pornography want to justify what they're doing. And what they say is, well, you know, this sex with myself, this internet stuff, it doesn't hurt anybody. It doesn't even hurt me. It's just a way I learn, I satisfy my curiosity. It's not real life. Well, I can stop whatever I want to. There's no real consequences to this. This is stuff I hear. Sometimes people talk about how, oh, it's just a game. You know, there's nothing serious about it. Well, I want to examine right now, is it a game? Is it a game? Does it do anything to us? Well, let's see. Here's what the research says. Viewing pornography releases the same chemicals into your brain that heroin and cocaine does. That's from a study in 2010. Well, all right. So we're releasing, that deals with those sexual hormones that during the sex act, those are released in the brain. Consistent exposure to pornography can rewire a person's brain. What that means is that the channels of the brain, when the brain is channeled to think about the pornography, then it becomes natural to think of those of that pornography. When the brain, on the other hand, is channeled to think about those things that are pure and wholesome, a good report, like we talked about this morning, then that's the way the brain goes. But the automatic response of the brain can be trained, and actually there's a rewiring of the brain. That's those that have their eyes full of adultery and cannot cease from sin, because the natural response for that person is to look at a woman as a sex object, or for the woman to look at a man as a potential partner. Well, that's what that's talking about. Patients with cyber sex, online pornography addiction report a level of stimulation that is difficult to replicate in real life with real people. That's a study by Carnes. And what that basically says is there is not a person alive that can successfully compete with a fantasy. Not a person alive. That means a husband, a wife. That means a boyfriend, a girlfriend. That means anybody. There's no one to compete with the fantasy. When we have trained our brain to be sexually satisfied with a fantasy, then we will find ourselves sexually numb to our real partner. Now, understand what I just said. Because I just said, if you're 12 years old and out here having sex with yourself, or you're 12 years old or whatever age you are, and you're out here finding your satisfaction on the internet, you're not just looking at porn. You are training your brain to be deviant. That's what that's about. And once you have started releasing those hormones, once you have awakened your sexuality, then what will happen is you will have trouble going back to being satisfied with just one person. That's why I tell people in premarital counseling, you need to come clean with each other. You both need to know what you're getting. Oh, the stories. A study of youth between the ages of 10 and 17 concluded that there is a significant relationship between frequent porn use and the feelings of loneliness and major depression. And absolutely there would be. Because what you have is relationship without contact. And that's going to give you that feeling of isolation and loneliness and major depression. By the way, not to speak of the social skills that you have not been able to hone as you've tried to woo and win someone. Those social skills are just off, not even in the equation here. Well, in pornography, many people see this as a safe place to go where there's no rejection, where relationships can be relatively simple. Let me say this, that women, not exclusively, but women tend to go to the chat rooms, to the relationship rooms. That's because when women are in a relationship, when women are in a romantic involvement, they want relationship. They want to feel nurtured, secure. They want to feel like they're the one and only. Men, on the other hand, go to the picture sites because it's the pictures that stimulate them. They are visual in this. Now, both are true, men and women, but more so of one than the other. But so we have the difference in sites. We have members of the church that are having online affairs with folks that aren't even in this country, and some that are in this country. We have members of the church who have gotten in their car and driven all the way to California to rendezvous with somebody they met on the internet, leaving behind a family wondering what's going on, and a lot of devastation in its path. This is a serious problem amongst us, folks, amongst members of the church. Here's the cycle. The pornography cycle. A person gets out here at the top, and so they have a craving or an urge of some sort. Maybe we're having a tough day on the job. We're having stress. We're having fuss or fight in our marriage. Something's going on, and we're feeling kind of, we got some moods going on. And so the sexual cravings, the tension starts building. Maybe it's been a while. And so the cravings and the tension starts building. And those cravings start looking for an object, looking for someone to fill this need that is developing with a craving. And then we have the next piece of the cycle is a person tries to deal with whatever is bringing pain into their life. But they're trying, in this cycle, they're trying to satisfy a mood issue with a sexual answer. And that's not how this works. That's not how God intends it to work. So we have, let's try to push the pain down. I feel lonely. I feel rejected. I feel whatever they're feeling. And then comes the fantasy. And then the hunt. So we get out here and we start searching, doing the mouse thing. And then we connect with something that is stimulating, that is exciting. And then we have the acting out, the fulfillment, the surfing. I've been able to go into a time bubble with all this, and now we've got the surfing and finding the person that we want to end this episode of surfing with, and then we have the fulfillment, followed by the guilt and the shame, the letdown, followed by the vow, I'll never do that again. I sure hope nobody finds me. And then there may be a period of a few days or maybe a while. And then the craving kicks in again. Now the question is, how do you break that cycle? And the truth is, you can break it at any point in the cycle. But here's what I want us to see. Is most folks stay on that merry-go-round and this thing just spirals and gets more and more intense as you go. Okay. Internet addiction is ambivalent, creates a sense of ambivalence because there's pleasure to it. It can be sexually satisfying. It can be more sexually satisfying than the real deal. And so that satisfaction kind of balances with, I shouldn't be doing this. And so that ambivalence, that teetering back and forth, goes in there. Sexual addiction is, in fact, somewhat encouraged by the world. It's not viewed as being wrong by the world. Oh, everybody does that. That's just a guy thing. And so that's excused. And when a Christian hears that, all a person that's got a problem with this has to hear is something that says it's okay. And they're going to go along with it in many cases. Sexual addiction is pleasurable. And yet what happens is, in time, it takes over. It hijacks your brain like the other addictions do. And will bring a person into a stronghold of Satan. Okay. What's the danger to society? Is it really something that is harmless? Well, 86% of convicted rapists confessed that they had their start with internet pornography. 86%. Now, what does that say? Evil men and seducers wax worse and worse. It doesn't stop where it starts. 57% of convicted rapists have actually, in their rape, have attempted to reenact the photographic images. And by the way, the stuff that's on the internet is very degrading to women. It gives the idea that women are sexually hot all the time and just takes a man to throw them around and satisfy them. And that's what's portrayed out there. I've sat in groups. Actually, I had an entire group of exotic dancers, if you can imagine, in a clinical setting. And I worked with that group of young women. And, you know, what I heard was some of the saddest stories. And the folks could only meet the folks that they see on the internet and fantasize about. There was not a woman in that group that had not been molested as a child, in all cases before age 7. They had grown up with their boundaries so violated that once someone has taken your innocence, their statement, it didn't really matter who's next. Oh, what a sad and wounded statement. And yet, here are some guys out here just fantasizing away about this. The fact is, those women that were in that group, none of them really liked men. And their statement is, all men are just alike. Well, I was the only man in the group, so I had to take the hit for everybody. But 57% of convicted rapists tried to reenact the pornographic images. 51% of male students exposed to violent pornography indicated the likelihood that they would rape a woman because of what they'd seen on the internet. 51%. That's pretty serious stuff. So we're saying it doesn't affect anybody? Well, pornography devalues the act of marriage. God has designed man and woman, and He's designed them where the parts fit and where they can enjoy one another. And when you're married, God gives you a free pass, and you can enjoy each other. But those that are caught in pornography devalue the act of sex or the act of marriage. They seek sexuality without relationship, humiliating sexual acts, and all kinds of perversion and other kinds of conduct. It's damaging to a marriage. Doesn't hurt anybody. It's damaging to a marriage because it creates an unrealistic demand on the wife or the husband of being that fantasy person and comparing the body of the person on the screen with the body of the husband or wife, which usually leaves the person feeling inadequate or unattractive. And then the anger that comes with the husband or the wife that is going to a screen, to an electronic device, to find their sexual satisfaction. Pornography, the pornographic images take place of the intimacy with the wife. And also what happens is once a husband or a wife have satisfied themselves with the electronic device, they may not want the real deal very often. And so that leads to, I don't know what's wrong with me. He's not coming around me much, or she's not coming around me much. I don't know what's wrong. We talked about the destruction that is there. The role of sex with oneself actually brings some levels of satisfaction that it shouldn't. For some, it's self-soothing. It releases the tension of a stressful day. It is something to help a person get out of a bad mood, and rightfully so, because you're releasing stuff in your brain. Sometimes it's an escape from a relationship or boredom or just chasing the highs, just like a drug addict would chase their chemical high. The porn addict chases their chemical high, only it's in their own system. They're chasing their own stuff. Now, what's the spiritual impact of all this? God intends the sexual expression to be only in the marriage relationship. And folks, If we're not preaching and teaching that so much people get tired of hearing it, we need to preach it and teach it until folks get tired of hearing it. Because that's what God says. We live in a very permissive society, and it is so easy to cross the boundaries that we have to say God intends the sexual expression to be only in the marriage relationship. You see, sexuality is not intended to be a selfish act. It's not intended to be something that lures a person into a marriage. But instead, the purpose of it is to be in the marriage to build up the marriage. That's where God put it. Pornography is a form of infidelity or adultery, at least in thought, against one's marital partner. Pornography and self-stimulation, as in sex with oneself, are disrespectful uses of the temple of God. And there's passages we talked about in Romans, and I have to go to Onan in this lesson to at least make a casual visit to him, where he spilled his seed on the ground, and because of that, there was a death penalty. You can go study that for yourself. Self-stimulation is devaluing the seed of life. Porn and self-stimulation increases the guilt and the shame in relating to God. And what I mean by that is the things done behind closed doors. Now when we come into a public forum and we sit here before God and putting on our Christian faces and our smiles and our generosity and our fellowship with one another, and we know that the night before or just this afternoon, I was out there looking at this stuff. That's not a confession. I wasn't. But here's a person sitting here talking about, oh, how I love Jesus, when they have gone against what Jesus teaches. Flee fornication. How is looking at pornography fleeing fornication? And then he talks about the one that sins, that commits fornication, sins against his own body. Well, there are many passages in the New Testament. The New Testament talks about lust, fornication. We looked at the Old Testament where the death penalties were. Here we see the concepts, and I want to focus in on this one in Hebrews 12 and verse 8. We have become too polite in our culture. We have taken terms such as the word bastard, and that is a good word, by the way, in its right context. And Paul, or the writer of Hebrews, talked about that. And he says, elsewhere you bastards. That had a connotation to it, a biblical connotation. But you know what we've done? We've taken that word and we talk about baby mama now. And we've, in our culture, in our liberal culture, we have redefined what God says is wrong. We've taken the label off the poison and have relabeled it as something that won't hurt you. Monday night in my heroin group, I sat and was working with three pregnant women. The fourth one was there too. And all of them have the same father. Now what's that like? What kind of family is that going to be? Where you got four siblings that grew up in the same neighborhood with the same father and four different mothers. How would you ever start to put that together? See, the Bible's got a term for that. It talks also about whoremongers. Those basically that their mind is just out here trying to find them a prostitute, or pros is what they call them down on the street corner. And the Bible still says, flee fornication and possess your own vessel in honor. Now here's something I want to end with tonight, and that is that sexuality and spirituality are linked together. Sex is not something we do behind closed doors or out in a parked car or in a motel room. And then church and our religion is something we do here. These two are linked together. I'm going to show you what I believe on this. The results of fragmenting our spirituality from our sexuality is this. When we commit our life to Christ, we also commit our bodies and with that our sexuality to the Lord. And we present these as a living sacrifice. You don't take your sacrifice back from Jesus. I talk to people and they say, oh, we haven't been intimate yet. It's like, define intimate. Well, sexual. That's not the definition of intimacy. You know why husbands and wives sometimes have a great deal of problem getting along with each other? Is because they haven't learned what intimacy is. I didn't say sex. They haven't learned what intimacy is. 940 times in the Old Testament, the word yada is used in connection with our relationship with God. And that is the word that we translate intimate. Intimacy. Now that's not a sexual relationship. But it is a oneness relationship we have with God. And the most frequent uses of this word are in connection with our relationship with God. There's a strong connection then between our sexuality and our spirituality. They are not two separate things as in opposite sides of the spectrum. They are together. Sexual choices have spiritual consequences. Look at 1 Corinthians 6, 15 through 20. And here he talks about, know ye not that your bodies are members of Christ? You see that? Shall I take away the members of Christ and make them members of a harlot? God forbid. Or do you not know that he that is joined to a harlot is one body? Now look at that. He didn't say one body in spirit. He said one body. There's a physical coupling, but the spiritual connection's not there. Look at this. And then he says, for the twain, said he, shall become one flesh. But he that is joined to the Lord is one spirit. And then this is in a sexual connotation because he says, flee fornication. And then he goes into that our bodies are a temple of the Holy Spirit. And he's got all that spiritual stuff tied right to this sex act. And he says, what? Are you taking your bodies and making them members of a prostitute? Or someone that is immoral? Someone you don't have a right to? What? Now that's spoken in the Las Vegas of New Testament times. But look at Ephesians 5 just very quickly. And there Paul is talking about the relationship and that Christ and the church have. And he says this statement in Ephesians 5. He says, this is a great mystery. When he talks about the husband and the wife being one, he says, this is a great mystery. But I speak regarding Christ and the church. And I have to ask the question, this is a great mystery. What is the mystery? The mystery is the comparison. Taking that which is obvious and illustrating that which is not obvious. And he says, I'm talking about Christ and the church. And he uses the union of a husband and wife as an illustration of the intimacy with Christ and the church. Do you not see that here he is talking not about a physical connection, not about word service, but he is talking about a spiritual connection in terms of that sexuality that illustrates the point of Christ in the church. Do you see that? Intimacy is a human longing to be known, to be cherished, to be valued, and to be loved. And I want to tell you, husbands, that starts way before the bedroom. And if that is not in the marriage, you're not going to have a happy marriage. Intimacy. Getting to know one another. As the old song, getting to know you, getting to know all about you. That's intimacy. I want to know you. No amount of sex is going to make up for a lack of intimacy. Hundreds of Christians are struggling with sexual issues. And unfortunately, in the silence of the church, they are often left to sort through harrowing experiences, such as childhood sexual abuse, exposure to pornography, raging temptations, homosexual thoughts, and even betrayal in marriage. And sometimes come and sit in the pews, hurting people who don't know who to talk to or where to turn for these answers. I'm here to tell you, help is here. Help is here. It's in God's Word. And these are things that even though they may be embarrassing to talk about, we've got to talk about them. People often want to be free of the bondage of the past, and they don't know where to turn as they try to find answers. We desperately need God's perspective on this. We do not have to suffer alone. God has spoken. There are good people that can help and that are worthy of our confidence. And fortunately, the Bible has a lot to say about it. In married life, God has given a permission slip to those that have said, I do, and commit themselves together for life. By the way, do you know why marriages stay together? Why do marriages stay together? It's not about love. That's the first thing most folks say. It's about commitment. Do we not admit that sometimes we're not real lovable in our marriages? Sometimes we're sick and we got the worst flu, and it's just not a real romantic moment. But we're still committed. We're super glued. We're gorilla glued together. I've got to upgrade. Okay. Now here's what I want us also to see. Remember this statement. Withholding sexual pleasure from yourself and your spouse is not a God-honoring thing. 70 to 80% of men rate sex as the most important aspect of marriage for them. And that doesn't sound like a guy thing. But when that sex is absent in the marriage, it's a big deal. It's a big deal. However, no one ever died from lack of sex. Cause of death, lack of sex. No. People can get by with that. Fact is, some have had to make themselves eunuchs for the kingdom's sake, and they don't have sex. Some are single for various reasons. Okay, we talked about a lot of this. So I'm going to zip through this. Husbands and wives are never going to solve problems in a marriage until they learn to talk about what's going on in the marriage, until they get on the same page with their goals and their understanding of each other, until they stop blaming and hurting each other and using withholding of sex as a weapon. God never intended that to be a weapon. There's a lot of different things that we could say tonight. In this, we need to talk about the past. And I want to just say this. It is not a sin to be tempted. But James talks about that process of biblical LSD, lust, sin, and death. It's not a sin to be tempted. Jesus was tempted. But it is a sin to yield to temptation. Our sin should not define us. I want to just, let me end with this one. The spiritual union that we just described in marriage is one man and one woman united as God has joined them together in marriage. One spirit and one flesh. That's what we've said tonight. Would you agree with that? That's God's plan. This is man's plan. The other woman, here is a husband or a wife that are having relations together, and there's somebody else in the bedroom. There's a flashbulb in the mind. And believe me, the marriage partner knows someone else is in. You're not all together here. You are comparing me somehow to somebody else. Whether it's the fantasy of a relationship on the internet, or whether it's viewing something, some picture, that fantasy is there. Inside your brain, and I end here, but inside your brain, you have a part that we talked about this morning that gives you the wow factor, and that is your amygdala. It's in the deep primal brain, and its purpose is to store everything you've ever done is remembered in the midbrain in that little thing called the amygdala, but the brain has kind of sorted that out and parked that over here as, okay, you know how to do all this. And all it needs is the trigger. When the trigger happens, then that thing that happened pops too. In other words, memories get triggered. So here's a person involved in sexual act in a legitimate relationship in marriage. And all of a sudden, this thing I stuck in my brain when I was 12, 15, whatever year old I was, something before marriage, all that stuff, that pops out. And now, during the sex act, the person is thinking about that instead of their wife or their husband. And those things just reap such travesty in a marriage. And they leave us feeling betrayed. So here's what I want us to get from this. We can train our brain to do the right thing, to think on the things that are wholesome and pure of good report. We can reset our brain to get on the right path. It takes a little time. But by all means, let us remember that intimacy and sex are not the same thing. And let us work on being intimate with our wife or husband. Let us not give them any reason to doubt us or to feel like trust has been broken. But let us bond together as one body, one spirit, one together in Christ, honoring our vows until death shall us part. And if you aren't married, then the sex part of your life needs to stop if it started right now. That's something that is saved from marriage. That's where God placed it. That's the only genuine way you can express it, is in marriage. If you're single and you plan to be married one day, somewhere on this planet, the person that you expect to marry is alive and well. What do you want them to be doing to prepare to be married to you? And are you preparing to be married to them? Let's bring ourselves to the marriage bed undefiled, if possible. And if we are defiled, then let us stop where we are and let us reset and let us practice self-control rather than self-will. Let us get our lives right with God. And by all means, if I have to go to heaven without my electronic devices, I'm going to heaven, but I'm for sure not going to hell because of them. May God bless you. We struggle with this. And may God bless you as you work to keep a handle on or get a handle on these things that can destroy our lives, our homes, our marriages, both internally, externally, and eternally. Is there someone here tonight that needs prayers, that needs help? Some congregations have support groups that get together. Folks that will talk with each other that have a similar problem, and they work with each other and give that support. Satan likes to keep us in secrecy. And tonight is the time to bust that secret and to make it known, whether publicly here or to someone else after the service. But make that known. Do not let Satan make you sick with your secrets. May God bless you. Tonight, if someone needs to respond, this is a time we're going to do that when we sing this song. And this is also a time that you can come and you can have your sins washed away if you're not a New Testament Christian. And you can put that old life behind you. You'll have struggles, but God has help. And His victory He'll give you is one that will overcome the world. It'll do it for all of us, but you've got to surrender 100% to Jesus before it'll happen. Won't you come while we stand and sing?